Okay. Well, thank you all for making your way here. Nice to see you. We'll start relatively on time. I know that it's a bit of a rush. I appreciate your efforts to get here. And I know all that Presbyterian fellowship is kind of tempting. You want to stay out there and have coffee and... But here we are. We are in Joshua this morning. If you want to find your way to the text that we are going to be using as the, at least something of the frame of reference for our conversation, we're talking about Egypt. This is the fourth of four conversations about Egypt. So if you're sick of Egypt, good news for you, this is it. We're moving on. Next week will be the last session we have together before the Christmas break. And so we'll have 3 weeks off. And then when we come back in January, we're going to shift our focus to Assyria, which is a very significant, I think you know, civilization of the ancient world and has a significant role to play in the history of God's people. There's a fair amount of the prophetic material in the Old Testament, especially the book of Isaiah, that presupposes Assyria and its threat, and so we'll be incorporating a discussion of that as well. So I think you'll find that interesting, and hopefully you'll be able to find your way back. Next week is kind of our little odd week, and I'm going to be looking for one quick week at the Hittites. So that big civilization that's up there in what we call Turkey, Anatolia, is going to be the focus of our conversation for just 1 week. If you're following along in the book, this is chapter 3, and you'll notice that chapter 3 also treats the Mycenaeans and the Phoenicians. But we're going to put that off. We're going to deal with the Mycenaeans in connection with Greece, and we're going to deal with the Phoenicians in connection with Carthage. And so both of those will incorporate later. So if you're a little bit OCD and wondering how come we're dropping out all that big chunk of material from chapter 3, then just know that that's only a temporary postponement and that we'll be coming back to it at a later time. So that's the schedule. And as I say right now, we are at Joshua chapter 23, which, as you know, is the tail end of the story of Joshua. And it represents that moment when the people of God have invaded Canaan, established themselves there, and we're just at that pivot point between the period that was dominated by Moses and then Joshua and the period that we call the period of the judges. And that's what I want to do with Egypt this morning, is kind of extend the story into that era that we call the period of the judges. Now, there's only some incidental points of contact here. It's not quite as dramatic as last week with the Exodus, but it rarely gets as dramatic as that. But we do still find Egypt having some role to play, and so I just want to kind of outline the history a little bit and note those points where there is some, at least, evidence of contact and some interesting little details that you may or may not be familiar with, but I think they are, to some degree, as surprising maybe as we go along. So the text that we're going to look at is, you know, this is still a little hot. I'm just going to kind of adjust this down. Let's try if that's any better. This is that point where we've just now gotten the people of God into Canaan. Joshua is at the end of his life. He knows that his days are numbered, and he wants to give a last kind of parting, inspirational speech to these people, and this is a record of that speech. My suspicion is it probably went on at some greater length than what's recorded here, but nevertheless, the heart of the matter, I think, is captured for us in this text. So we'll read this entire chapter, and we'll note the... Sorry, no, that won't work. You know, I should think this through in advance. It's like an intelligence test. And every week I fail. There. Okay, got it. How can this be so hard, you know? So Joshua chapter 23, and as I say, this is Joshua toward the end of his career now, giving this parting word of encouragement to God's people who have now established themselves. This would take place about 1375 or so B.C. And so Joshua 23, verse 1, the word of God. A long time afterward, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies all around, and Joshua was old and well advanced in years, Joshua summoned all Israel, their elders and heads, their judges and officers, and said to them, I'm now old and well advanced in years, and you've seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who has fought for you. I've allotted to you as an inheritance for your tribes those nations that remain, along with all the nations that I have already cut off, from the Jordan to the Great Sea in the west. The Lord your God will push them back before you and drive them out of your sight, and you shall possess your land as the Lord your God promised you. Therefore be very steadfast to observe to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right nor to the left, so that you may not be mixed with those nations left here among you, or make mention of the names of their gods, or swear by them, or serve them, or bow yourselves down to them, but hold fast to the Lord your God as you've done to this day. For the Lord has driven out before you great and strong nations. And as for you, no one has been able to withstand you to this day. One of you puts to flight 1,000, since it is the Lord your God who fights for you as he promised you. Be very careful, therefore, to love the Lord your God. For if you turn back and join the survivors of these nations left here among you and intermarry with them so that you marry their women and they yours, know assuredly that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out before you, but they shall be a snare and a trap to you, a scourge on your sides and thorns in your eyes until you perish from this good land that the Lord your God has given you. And now I'm about to go the way of all the earth. And you know in your hearts and souls, all of you, that not one thing has failed of all the good things the Lord your God promised concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one of them has failed. But just as in all the good things the Lord your God has promised concerning you, have been fulfilled for you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the bad things until he has destroyed you from this good land that the Lord your God has given you. If you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he enjoined on you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land he has given you. So great blessing, great warning in this final speech that we have from Joshua. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll get underway. Our Father, we're grateful to you for your many mercies to us. We thank you for this word of great blessing, this word of warning. We pray that we would have ears to hear the message that we should hear from it. We pray that our review now of this ongoing story of your people and the historical setting in which they lived out their lives would be enriched through the presence of your Spirit, and we ask these things in the name of Christ. Amen. All right, so we left off last week, if you were here, right at the Exodus. And the people of God are just now on the cusp of the Red Sea, as you recall. We kind of got them to that point. The Pharaoh of the Exodus is Amenhotep II, and this is all taking place in the 18th dynasty. I want to finish up the 18th dynasty this morning briefly. That takes us down to 1293, and then get a little bit into the 19th dynasty, which carries us through the bulk of that period that we call the era of the judges. Amenhotep II is presumably the pharaoh of the Exodus. We're guessing the Exodus took place around 1446, 1447, which would be 480 years prior to the beginning of the building of Solomon's temple, and that's the date that the Old Testament itself gives us. So we're going off of that Old Testament chronology. Amenhotep II, as you know, started off as kind of a great military character. He had all the DNA of his father, Thutmose III, in him. He was probably going to go out and even do more world-conquering things, but something happened early in his reign, and really, it's very interesting, the rest of the story of Amenhotep II is strangely quiet. It's almost as if there'd been some great cataclysm, like, well, maybe an exodus that sort of deflated him and left him without the wind in his sails. We don't hear anything of the exodus from Egyptian annals. It's just a big gaping hole there. But we certainly see a dramatic change in the overall style of this king who had, at least at the beginning, seemed to be so full of promise, so full of military exploits and so on. The children of Israel, meantime, of course, have escaped from Egypt, and they spend 1 year at Mount Sinai. Now, if you recall, the at least route that we're postulating, this is not a majority view, but I'm happy to report to you there is no majority view. So, you know, this just happens to be one hypothesis that I personally find rather intriguing, and that is that the children of Israel escaped from Egypt, got a head start probably of about 2 weeks. That's about what it would take to cover the north middle part of the Sinai Peninsula. At a certain point, very strangely, at the first part of Exodus 14, they are commanded to go back. And it's not real clear what go back means. It seems like they should go forward, but in fact, the command is to go back. They wouldn't go north because that takes them to the region of the Philistines, and they've already been told not to do that. They wouldn't go back to Egypt, and so go back most likely means to go back and down south, and that would funnel them into this little peninsula here that we talked about last week called the Nueva Peninsula. You get there through this rather narrow wadi. It's broad enough to accommodate the people who are making their way there, but certainly it doesn't allow much of an escape route. The hypothesis is that that's the point where the Red Sea crossing would have taken place. There is a kind of strange land bridge. It's usually submerged, but if you could take away the water, it's a rather gradual descent and ascent on the other side that would accommodate the kind of thoroughfare that we're discussing here. This is all hypothesis. It's all speculation. Some people have gone scuba diving out there trying to find artifacts, you know, and there's been a mixed response as to what exactly has been discovered. So I'm just leaving that off the table for right now, but certainly it's been an interesting thought. It's been one of many theories that are suggested and the one that I personally find most intriguing. From there, they would have gone north to what is called Mount Sinai, but Mount Sinai is most likely in Midian, present-day Saudi Arabia. It is the standard Jewish view. It is the view of the Apostle Paul. Paul says in Galatians, Mount Sinai in Arabia, in Galatians. Arabia is a name that applies to this part of the world, not to the Sinai Peninsula. It's the view that was taken by Josephus. It's the view that was taken by the Septuagint version. It's the standard classical Jewish view that Mount Sinai is over in this region of the world, not in the lower part of the Sinai Peninsula. So I feel on pretty safe ground to propose to you that that's actually the location of that mountain. What particular mountain it is, nobody knows. It's a very mountainous and rugged area. There have been certain that have been suggested, and certainly there's some attractive alternatives there, but we can at least say probably that it would be in this region. It makes sense because Moses met God at the burning bush in Midian and was told, you'll come back to this mountain with these people, and so we would expect that that would be the location. So anyway, they spend 1 year at Sinai. They're receiving the law. They're building the tabernacle. All of that's taking place. And then, as you know, they spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness in and around that region, probably within about a 100 or 200 mile radius from that location. All right, so that's what's happening with the children of Israel. The next king we run into in Egypt is Thutmose IV. He rules from 1419 to 1386. This gets us into the period of the judges in Israel. Thutmose is a good-looking guy. You see him there? And one of the better preserved mummies, you know. He even has a little hair still on top. You can see that. He obviously died happy. Interestingly, there was a contest over succession involving Thutmose IV. And that doesn't surprise us because you recall the firstborn son of Amenhotep II would have died the night of the Passover. And that would throw open, at least to some degree, a question as to who is the legitimate successor to the throne. And we know that Thutmose IV had to do a little bit of propaganda work to establish his own claim to the throne. This is mainly in a stele that's called the Dream Stele. And if you can make it out there, you'll see on the left is a pharaoh, that's Thutmose IV. On the right is a kind of image of a sphinx. And the story is, as told by Thutmose IV, that he was sleeping at the feet of the sphinx. And a god came to him and told him that if he would remove the sand that had covered up the paws of the sphinx, that he could be the next ruler of Egypt. And so he busily got to work and did that, and on that basis, he was guaranteed succession. Now, that's a very odd story, isn't it? But all it says to us is that there was some question about whether Thutmose IV actually had a legitimate claim to the throne. And we would only expect that to happen if the guy that was actually the obvious claimant to the throne was gone, and that would have been the firstborn son of Amenhotep. So it at least is somewhat cooperative. It doesn't prove anything definitively either way, but it's an interesting little detail that seems at least compatible with the Exodus account that we've all otherwise talked about. His reign is otherwise undistinguished. He's a peaceful guy. In fact, most of the pharaohs from this point on tend to be rather pacifist. We don't have a whole lot of military activity going on for the most part. At the same time, there is a rising threat far to the north involving a group that is called the Hittites. And as I said, we're going to look at them next week. You hear of the Hittites in the Old Testament. For many years, people didn't really think they amounted to much, and then it's been discovered in the last century or so that there was a huge and formidable Hittite empire in the north for a fairly, well, a relatively brief period of time, but at the time that they were a dominant power, they were certainly a force to be reckoned with. Egypt is aware of them and forms a treaty with another group called the Mitanni. So this is kind of the lay of the land in 1400 B.C., just as the children of Israel are entering Canaan and establishing themselves there and driving out those other tribes that are viewed as worthy of being expulsed, this is kind of what we look like. So in the south, you see Egypt reaching up. There's Canaan. The Amaru refers to the Amorites. This orangish region, kind of yellow-orange there, are the Mitanni. They last only a brief period of time. They're fairly significant, but fairly brief. And then further north, in darker orange, are the Hittites. Off to the right on the map is Babylon and the Kassite Empire. That's the way things look, more or less, in the year 1400. And so what you have is Egypt, concerned about the Hittites, forming an alliance with the Mitanni, and Israel is sort of sandwiched in the middle of all of this international geopolitics at that point. All right. Israel's invasion of Canaan would have taken place in the 7 years or so between 1407 and 1400. The book of Joshua tells us that it took about 7 years to do the substantial project of conquering Canaan. Obviously, it continues for a good long time after that, but this seven-year period is the principal era in which this is happening. So this kind of lines up the dots there a little bit. All right, the next ruler is Amenhotep III. He reigns from 1386 to 1349. Again, fairly peaceful, not a lot of military activity going on. He had a somewhat religious focus in his own interest. He again allies with the Mitanni to meet this rising Hittite threat. It's during his reign that Joshua dies in about the year 1375. So the speech that we read a few minutes ago would have taken place about this time. And then we have the next one, who is Amenhotep IV. And this is an interesting guy. He's better known to us as Akhenaten. He is one of Egypt's most famous and, in my opinion, oddest pharaohs. He's a strange-looking guy for openers there. But he has this interesting headdress that we've talked about earlier. He's got the kind of the implements of his rule, the crook and the rod and so on. He takes the throne in Egypt when there are mounting problems internationally. And he becomes a very interesting character for our purposes. Hittite power is more or less approaching the height of its threatening character at this point. This is about 1350. The Hittites have driven out the Mitanni, and so now if you look closely, you'll see there that the Hittites are coming down to a city called Kadesh, and the Egyptians in the north are reaching up to the north to that same region. So that's kind of the point where the two sides cross. Hittite power is large and threatening. The Egyptians are feeling it, and Akhenaten is the guy who's kind of caught in the middle of this. There's also rising Assyrian power in the east. As I said, in January, we're going to start taking a look at the Assyrians. So here's kind of the picture of things about 1350, about 50 years later. Off on the left, you have the Mycenaeans. We're skipping them for now. We'll pick them up when we talk about the Greeks, the Minoans, the Mycenaeans, the Trojan War, all of that we're going to take a look at a little bit later. Egypt, of course, there in the middle, up to the top is the Hittites, and over on the right, Assyria, and its city at Asher. So there's the kind of the lay of the land, the big picture, Israel right in the middle with these four great slices of the pie, all vying for some degree of control and pressure. Now, if you close in, I'm sorry, this map isn't the best, but you'll kind of get the point here. If you close in to the region that's called Canaan, there's some interesting things happening. Phoenicia is right there. Phoenicia is a little set of cities right on the coast of the Mediterranean. It's about five cities you've heard of: Tyre, Sidon, Byblos, present-day Beirut is one of them, Berytos was the ancient name, and so on. These are five more or less semi-independent cities, but they all share together a common economic arrangement in which they more or less dominate trade on the sea, and they have a very close connection to Egypt. I see eyes glazing over out there. You're going to like this, so just listen up. The kings of Phoenicia are feeling pressure. And the pressure is coming from them, from the north and from the south. The north is squeezing the Phoenicians, and it comes in the form of the Hittites. The king, his name is Supalulumus. What mother would give that name to a kid? I don't know. Supalulumus, but he's a very powerful and threatening character, and he is coming down from the north and squeezing the Phoenicians. This is 1350. The kings of the Phoenicians are writing letters to Akhenaten. They're pleading with him to come and help them. Akhenaten is supposed to be their ally. He's supposed to be the one who is going to support them because they have had a working relationship for many years. But Akhenaten seems to be uninterested. And these Phoenicians get increasingly desperate because they have both the Hittites coming from the north, but also they're complaining about another group that's pressuring them from the south, who are called in these letters the Apiru. Now, the Apiru is an interesting term, and it pops up in various contexts, but there are fairly respectable scholars, not necessarily Bible scholars or Christian scholars, but simply scholars of ancient history, who believe that that word Apiru, or its alternative rendering Hapiru, could actually be the original root of the word Hebrew. And if that's the case, then again, it makes a very interesting kind of picture of what's going on. You've got the Phoenicians here in the middle complaining about a squeeze play coming from two sides. The Hittites crowding them from the north, and this other group crowding them from the south, who are called by them the Apiru, arguably the Hebrews, who have now taken control of Canaan and are beginning to press their borders in all directions, including incursions into regions that were otherwise controlled by the Phoenicians. And so it's one of those rather subtle points, which has nevertheless been interesting by standards of, you know, trying to correlate biblical history with what's otherwise known in the ancient world. So the kings of the Phoenicians are writing to Akhenaten, pleading with him for help, but Akhenaten basically is turning a deaf ear. He's a pacifist. He's kind of a religious character, and he's not interested in getting involved in these military expeditions to help his erstwhile friends up there in Phoenicia. Akhenaten himself was fully preoccupied with a monotheistic religion. This is interesting. Egypt, of course, throughout the bulk of its history has been polytheistic, with just a couple of notable exceptions. This is one of them. Akhenaten comes to the throne, and he is ferociously determined to lead Egypt into a monotheistic religious outlook. He associates the one true God with the sun, and the name that's assigned to that sun god is Aten, and hence he gives himself the name Akhenaten. He views himself as a priest of this god, and indeed views himself as the one true and exclusive priest of this one true God. This is not the worship of the true God of the Bible. I don't want to go that far or imply any such thing, but it is interesting that still within shouting distance of the Exodus, you have a Pharaoh who comes along who is so deeply persuaded that there is only one God that he basically delegitimizes the polytheistic religion of Egypt and insists that people worship this one God, and he himself holds himself out as the priest of that God. And so if you look at this relief here, the sun is this god Aten, the rays are coming down, you probably can't see it, but at the end of each ray is a little hand, and the hand is supposed to be a mark of blessing, hence blessings are coming from this god, and that is Akhenaten himself, who has, by anybody's estimates, a very strange figure. Let's just face it. And this is odd because this is the way he's always depicted. It's a very female kind of figure that is always associated with Akhenaten. Some people have speculated, as you can probably imagine, all kinds of things. But he was a father, he had lots of kids, and so he was otherwise apparently a normal guy. But the pictures of him have always left a little bit of a strange impression about exactly what he was trying to purport, you know, himself to be. But anyway, there he is. He moves the capital of Egypt to Akhenaten, and that's where these Armana archives were discovered. These have been very helpful, very useful discoveries. It's within the last 120 years or so that these discoveries have been made, and it gives deep insight into the time. But as I say, for our purposes, the most important and striking discovery was the complaints that were coming from Phoenicia, found in those Armana letters, with respect to the pressure they were experiencing from the Hittites and from the Apiru. All right, quickly, the rest of the 18th dynasty, we have another guy, he just reigns a couple of years, Menkaure, and then a character that you all are familiar with, of course, Tutankhamun. So he comes in 1334 to 1325. He is probably one of the most famous pharaohs, even though he was a very minor pharaoh at the time. There was a great deal of question for a long time whether he even existed. It was very obscure until a kind of obsessive archaeologist, I'll say, named Howard Carter, was determined to find his tomb and did so in about the year 1922. And what was interesting was that the tomb of Tutankhamun was discovered more or less unmolested by tomb raiders. Most of these tombs had been, you know, from time immemorial, already raided and gutted of their contents. But this one was found more or less intact. He was a young fellow. He was a teenager. His rule was fairly brief, 1334 to 1325. He immediately reinstated traditional worship in Egypt. The polytheistic religion was put back in place. The monotheistic religion of Akhenaten was terminated. He died of rather mysterious and apparently violent causes when he was still a teenager, probably about 19, maybe 20 years of age. So his rule is fairly brief. It's uninteresting from a historical point of view, but he's very interesting because of the discoveries that were made about him. But anyway, that's where he shows up. The next guy rules rather briefly. His name is Ai. He rules for about 4 years. And then the last king of the 18th dynasty is Horemheb. And he, again, is kind of a fellow that marries in to the family. He's not a legitimate descendant of that family, but he, through the marriage, becomes a ruler as well. He attempted to reinstate Egyptian power with some degree of success, but by this time, Egypt had kind of spent itself. He has no male heir, and thus he leaves control of Egypt to his vizier, who was a man by the name of Ramses. And if you know anything about Egypt, you know that Ramses becomes one of the great names of Egyptian history. So that's the 18th dynasty. We looked at it last week and this week, and there it is with the ribbon on it. And of course, at this time, the people of God are here in Canaan. They're settling in. This has now gotten us well into the era that's called the era of the judges. Just a quick sketch about the early part of the 19th dynasty. Ramses I ruled for only 2 years. He was this vizier. He was an elderly guy by the time he excuse me for a second. Here's my notes for this lecture. There we are. Don't want to forget any parts. So there's, he just rules for a couple of years. He's an older guy. Seti I takes over from there, 1291 to 1278. He renews a certain amount of Egyptian art and prestige and so on. He led some campaigns into Syria. He took Kadesh. That brings us to Ramses II. This is usually known as Ramses the Great. He is an interesting character. We don't really have a whole lot of concern about him in terms of biblical history, but just in his own right, he's quite an interesting character. A great deal of the statuary that we associate with Egypt is Ramses the Great. This is one typical shot, and of course there's many, and you recognize that image, I'm sure. He was the father of over 100 children. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? But he was pretty productive in that regard. He fought the Hittites at a battle called the Battle of Kadesh, and this took place in 1276. Now, Kadesh is right at the seam between the Hittites on the north and Egypt on the south. And so it's that border city, and this is the greatest single battle that has taken place in military history in, you know, up until that time. It was a huge conflict between the two most powerful nations of the world at the time, 1276, right smack dab in the middle of the era of the judges. Obviously, Israel at this point is not a significant enough power to certainly be a player in this conflict, and there's no reference to it directly in the Old Testament, but it is a time of considerable activity, and this is kind of the point where it culminates. Israel is down to the south there, sort of insinuating itself into that region. The Egyptians under Ramses II and the Hittites under Hattusili fought to a draw at that border city. So it's a major conflict and there is no clear-cut winner. But Ramses, who was a master politician, nevertheless passed himself off to the Egyptian people as the great and victorious ruler and conqueror of the Hittites at this Battle of Kadesh. And so he does all kinds of things to try to portray himself as this great and effective ruler, and this is the kind of imagery that we find. This is a shot of Ramses, who's on the back of a chariot, who's got his bow drawn, and this is a picture of the Battle of Kadesh, in which he's picturing himself as out there, actively participating in the battle, winning a great victory. So even though the outcome of the battle itself was ambivalent, nevertheless, he uses it for propaganda purposes throughout the rest of his career. But other than that, he doesn't do a whole lot militarily. This is the single point where you have a kind of major military event that takes place in terms of this guy. The next ruler after Ramses the Great is Merimtah. I'm going to stop with this one. I just want to add one detail here. Merimtah rules only for 10 years. He's the 13th son of Ramses, because the first 12 of his sons had died. Ramses outlived the first 12 of his sons. So the 13th son is the guy that is able to take the throne, Merimtah. He is best known in history as the one who fought a group called the Sea People. The Sea People are a somewhat mysterious bunch that came in about this time. It's about the time of the Trojan War, about 1200 or a little earlier. And they come in both by land and by sea. They seem to have come from the far north. They come sweeping through Mycenae. They are the ones who basically dismantle the Hittites. They're a warlike people, and they sort of mix these others along with them. So it seems that this is not a rapid invasion, but it takes place over time, and they sort of conquer these people and bring them along with them. And especially the Mycenaeans seem to have been swept up with the sea people, at least some of them seem to have been carried along, and they wind up at the border of Egypt, when Merimtah was the ruler. Now Merimtah meets them and fights them in 1203, and he successfully resists their invasion. And he records this invasion by these sea people on a stele, which is called the Israel stele. It should be called the Merimtah stele, I suppose, but it's called the Israel stele, and this is a picture of it, in which he gives a detailed account of his war against the sea people. But one of the interesting lines, which has been by far the most intriguing and famous line of this so-called Israel stele, is a line that says, Israel is laid waste and has no seed. Now, what makes that interesting is this is the first time we have any artifact that's ever been discovered in which some kind of express reference is made to Israel by a nation besides Israel. So here for the first time in around the year 1200, Israel is being referred to as an existing nation. And it's being referred to by an Egyptian ruler who is describing to some degree his conflict with the sea people and his military activity in a region that is occupied by Israel. And one of the throwaway lines he makes at this point is that Israel itself has been laid waste and has no seed. Now, there's a couple little side points about this that are interesting. One, it's propaganda. You know, Israel obviously was not laid waste, and it did have plenty of seed and survived for a long time. This is the kind of thing that people would do when they're reporting their own military activities. But more important, it says Israel is there. And it says it's there as a significant enough presence to warrant mention by this rather major military character, Merimtah, who's fighting a battle with the sea people. And so from a point of view of those who've tried to make the establishment of Israel rather late, this is an embarrassment, because it says that Israel has been there long enough to have kind of set itself up as an existing, recognized nation in the, you know, ancient Near Eastern setting. So that's been an extremely interesting and somewhat controversial that we find, and it dates to about 1203, right again in sort of the middle and toward the later part of the era of the judges. Now, the other little detail about the sea people, just I'll leave it at this, they were pushed back by Merimtah, and they were pushed back by Ramses III on a second conflict back into the region of Israel, southern Israel, that is south of Israel, north of Egypt, into that kind of region there, and they settled there. And there are pretty cogent arguments to be made that the sea people are actually the forerunners of those people who came to be called the Philistines, who eventually, of course, play such a role in later biblical history. And that's why when archaeology has been done with respect to the Philistines and the cities that are famous for them, Ashdod, Gaza, and certain others that are Gath, you know, those cities that are mentioned in the Old Testament, that Mycenaean pottery has been found. And it seems that it was actually pottery that was reflecting the culture of the Mycenaeans who'd been picked up by these sea people and deposited there at the region just south of Israel and north of Egypt. So again, it's one of those interesting little details that may or may not float your boat, but nevertheless, it is the kind of thing that people like to notice about all of this. All right, with that said, I'd like to come back and make a couple of comments here, including about the text that we read. Joshua is giving this speech that we read from Joshua chapter 23 in about 1375. So it's about 150 years or so prior to the events that we've just been looking at. He's right at the beginning of this era of the judges, and we've taken an overview of at least the first half of the period of the judges. and notice what's going on. The things that I'd like to remind you of from Joshua's speech that I think are important for us is that, first of all, Joshua makes this comment. He says, not one thing has failed of all that God has promised you concerning the land. So Joshua is commenting on the land, and he's commenting on the fact that God has given these people the land. He has supernaturally empowered them, fought with them and for them, and they have successfully driven out those who were worthy of being driven out from an Old Testament point of view, so that Israel could establish itself. And they were so successful in doing this that Joshua can say, not one thing God has promised concerning the land has failed. Hence, there are no unfulfilled promises to Israel with respect to the land. If you have ears to hear, then you might catch the significance of that. The history of Israel's connection to the land is tumultuous from this point on. They have their ups and they have their downs. The Assyrians deport major, portions of the population. The Babylonians sack Jerusalem. And on it goes. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament, you know that there's this ongoing kind of struggle with respect to the land. And sometimes they do well and sometimes not so well. The whole thing seems to culminate in the New Testament era when finally, after Assyria, after Babylon, finally Rome puts, as it were, a definitive end to the relationship between the Jewish population and the land. They drive out in 70 AD the Jewish population. They level Jerusalem, leave it a wasteland, rename it Palestine in celebration of who? The name Palestine comes from what? Philistine. And so it was a slap in the face. The Romans are trying to slap the Jewish population in the face by doing knowingly, consciously something that will say to those people, you have forfeited this land forever. That would be the Roman view. And we're going to name it for your enemies. We're going to name it the land of the Philistines, the Palestine land, you see. So whatever took place afterwards, at least the one thing we should have in mind is that God did not fail to give the people what he had promised, at least according to Joshua in Joshua 23. And anything that happened after that was no abrogation of God having fulfilled his promise to them. That's first point. Second point, as we come to the New Testament and ask, what do we make of this question of the land? One of the things that's interesting is that most of the promises that are given to Abraham as part of the Abrahamic covenant in the Old Testament are repeated in the New Testament. There will be a blessing and so on. You know, all kinds of promises are included in the promise to Abraham. But the one thing that's conspicuously absent in the New Testament reiteration of the promises to Abraham is any express reference to the land. That is not pictured as part now of the ongoing kind of promise that God is giving to his people. What's placed instead in that, where you would expect to hear the land, is the word the cosmos, the world. So for example, in Romans chapter 4, we're told that Abraham and his seed are heirs of the cosmos, the universe. And in a sense, in the Old Testament, the land becomes a shadow of a much richer blessing that God bestows on his people in the New Covenant era. And that's why, some of you kind of see where I'm going with this, and I'm just going to kind of boldly go here for a second. We should be cautious trying to attach too much significance to a piece of real estate today, given the way the New Testament itself conceives of the manner in which God has fulfilled his promises to his people, you see. So the second little point to make is simply that one, that we do have certainly an important role for the land in the Old Testament, but from the New Testament point of view, there's a shift in the focus, and indeed the way in which God's promises to his people are conceived of is rather in terms of this much richer and more sweeping kind of package of benefits. The third thing and final thing I want to note here is still, and this is kind of more the Sunday school lesson now for the morning. Notice what Joshua says. Not one thing that God has promised has he failed to provide. And we as God's people can embrace that and say in the same way and with even greater confidence, not one thing that God has promised to us has he failed to provide. And the New Testament is robust in its great celebration of the way that God has made good on that promise. My friends, not one thing that God has promised to you has he failed to provide.
Amen.
Hey. Sometimes we get a little fixated on the small stuff, you know what I'm saying? Little details come along, little irritants, little problems. Let's never lose sight that if God be for us, who can be against us? Let's never lose sight of the fact that as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3, he has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in heavenly places. Let's never lose sight of the fact that now to him who has done exceeding abundantly above all we can ask or imagine, to him be glory forever. We live in this wonderful kind of explosive truth that God has given us the cosmos, richly, richly to share. And when the little things come along and kind of derail us and cause us upset, we can say with Joshua only in a much deeper and richer sense, there's not one thing God has promised us that he hasn't provided. And I think you'll agree with me, that is pretty good news. Amen? So we can share in the promise that God made to his people and even more richly rejoice in it.